Oh, I forgot to start recording. Session on Friday morning, and I don't have any specific announcements to begin with today. We had a good lecture on Wednesday. In case you weren't able to join us for that, of course, you can get the lecture. The way you can get all the materials online in archive format. And of course, anybody can have access to those to review as often as you like. Remember that we have the optional extra credit activity of participating on the Mises Wiki, and you can find information about that near the top of the main course page. So, Danny, I don't know if you have any other announcements. If so, please feel free to join in and make them in the chat window. Otherwise, I'm ready to get started, to have some Q&A, to talk a little bit about talk more about the materials that we covered on Wednesday. I'm sure that a lot of you have questions. There's some great discussion going on the forums, and happy to see that, and happy to encourage even more of that. There have been some questions raised about the readings, and you know, I should clarify, I'm sure it's obvious, but you know, this is not one of those classes where all of the assigned readings consist of things that, you know, that I personally would endorse, or that, you know, that I agree with the authors on every point. In some cases, I quite disagree with the authors on many points, but the idea is to give you exposure to kind of a wide range of literature dealing with these issues. You know, there's been some discussion about the Wired article by Kevin Kelly. I talked on in lecture one about Kelly's book, New Rules for the New Economy. And, you know, I think Kelly is a good example, or his books provide a good example of this particular genre that we talked about in week one, this kind of excited, breathy, exaggerated, you know, style of making sort of wild and difficult to substantiate claims about the internet, about the networked economy, and so on. And I think we want to train ourselves to sort of spot those and to be careful readers, and not, of course, to, you know, take everything that we read on this topic at face value, but to scrutinize it more closely. And, you know, certainly the same is true, for example, of the article by Varian that we read this week. I think Varian is, you know, I think his work is quite good. He is a neoclassical economist, not an Austrian economist by any stretch of the imagination. And some of his work is a little bit sort of narrow and technical in the same way that modern neoclassical economics can be narrow and technical. So Varian is no Austrian, but I think there are a lot of important lessons for everybody in his book with Carl Shapiro, Information Rules, and also in some of the shorter readings that we've been looking at. I think his little New York Times piece dealing with Ronald Coase that we looked at last week is quite good as well. So I'm sure that's obvious. I don't mean to be patronizing by pointing this out, but do keep in mind that we're reading a variety of things, and you should feel free to attack, to embrace, or to attack and critique and wrestle with everything that you read. Of course, my own lectures, that, you know, the rule doesn't apply to that. I mean, you have to embrace, you know, without question, every single thing that I say. And I'll send you some Kool-Aid in the mail if you need that to help you get in the right spirit. So anyway, don't be shy, folks. How about questions, comments, objections, suggestions? As I said during last week's office hours, let's start with questions that are, you know, specifically related to this week's discussion, this week's material, readings, lecture, or last week's if you prefer. But if, you know, if we run out of those and you want to ask questions or start a discussion on any topic under the sun, that's fine with me. If I have something intelligent to say about it, I will. Otherwise, I'll just keep my mouth shut and see what else pops up in the chat window. But go ahead, let's get some questions or comments. imagining that I can hear furious typing as people struggle to formulate their brilliant questions. Oh, excellent. Okay. Some questions are coming in. Let me start with Michael's question about Microsoft and antitrust. We'll say a lot more about that in weeks 4 and 5. Let me just make a few brief comments on it now. First of all, there were multiple actions that were brought against Microsoft, at least two by the U.S. Justice Department, another major antitrust case brought by the European Antitrust Authority. And there were a lot of different issues that were involved related to things that we talked about this week. Some of it had to do with Microsoft's pricing strategy, right? So one of the complaints was that Microsoft was illegally tying one product to another, or bundling, selling a bundle of products rather than individual products, sort of each on their own. And some of you may remember back in the 90s, the old timers may remember one of the big issues was the web browser. So the early versions of Windows had a very primitive web browser, and the dominant web browser in the early to mid 90s was Netscape Navigator, the forerunner of today's Mozilla Firefox. And Microsoft introduced its own browser, Internet Explorer, which most people thought, at least early on, was, you know, inferior to Netscape Navigator. But the argument was Microsoft was able to pre-install Internet Explorer on the desktop, to put the icon on the desktop. In other words, to offer it as a part of Windows that consumers could get for free. Netscape Navigator, while it was also given away for free, it required a few extra steps to download it and install it. And, you know, people were not, the average consumer was a little bit less computer savvy than today. You know, downloading programs, downloading apps, if you like, was not as common in those days. The argument was Microsoft was taking advantage of its monopoly, in its alleged monopoly in the operating system, in Windows, to sort of squeeze out rival producers of complementary products like a web browser, antivirus software, and so on, that Microsoft would sort of wait to see what technologies consumers would want, and then make its own versions of them, include them with Windows, in other words, give them away for free, and basically squeeze out the competitors. And no one else could compete with Microsoft in these applications markets. That was one of the critiques. And, you know, as we saw earlier this week, producing and selling information goods, doing business in the networked economy, you know, sometimes does involve some slightly different techniques and strategies. For example, you know, choosing a bundle of products and selling the bundle rather than the individual products, you know, that may be an effective way for the seller to maximize profits, not necessarily by keeping rivals out of the market, but rather by offering kind of an integrated bundle that the consumer actually prefers. One example that was used at the time is, you know, a man can go to the clothing store and buy a suit that comes with a jacket and pants, or maybe a three-piece suit with a vest. It shouldn't be required by law that the clothing store also sell them as separates. We can buy one pair of pants and a different jacket. You know, you can mix and match. If stores want to sell mix and match, they can. Of course, lots of stores sell dress pants and men's jackets separately. Maybe they are made out of the same material. Maybe they're made out of complementary materials. Who cares? I mean, firms can do that if they want. But a lot of men prefer to buy the suit together. They know that the material is a match and the cut is the same or whatever. And it should be up to the market to decide what's kind of the optimal bundle. If McDonald's wants to charge one price for the Big Mac and French fries and Coke separately, and another price for the Happy Meal, well, that's, you know, there's no there's no conspiracy or no antitrust. There's no sort of market violation in doing so. Bill Gates himself, used the example of buying a newspaper. He said, suppose you like to read the New York Times, but you prefer the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. Well, you know, the government cannot require a reseller, say Barnes and Noble, where you can buy newspapers, you know, to offer each section of the paper by itself. Or, to put it another way, Gates said, suppose that Barnes and Noble wants to sell the front page of the New York Times and the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, and so it buys copies of the New York Times and then takes a pair of scissors and cuts out the editorial page and then, you know, pastes on the Wall Street Journal editorial page and sells that as the New York Times. Gates said, well, the New York Times would have every right to object to that and to refuse to sell, you know, copies of the paper at wholesale prices to Barnes and Noble. Or to require Barnes & Noble to say, look, if you're going to sell our paper, you have to sell the whole thing unadulterated, just the way we delivered it to you. That's part of the contract. If you don't like those terms, well, fine. Well, we will not let you be an authorized reseller of the New York Times. Again, no big deal. That's, you know, market participants can negotiate and bargain over this and work it out. Well, the Justice Department's claim was that Microsoft was telling resellers, HP, Compaq, Dell, you know, companies that were selling PCs, that if they wanted to preload Windows on their computers, they could not alter it. They couldn't remove the Internet Explorer icon from the desktop or uninstall the program altogether. They couldn't put Netscape Navigator on the desktop. They couldn't, you know, alter the user experience in other ways that Microsoft didn't approve of. The argument was, well, this is unfair. This is Microsoft trying to squeeze out or keep out rivals. There are a number of different kind of specific technical objections we could make to these charges against Microsoft. But the simple one now is the obvious one is just to point out that, look, there are lots of different ways to sell stuff. If HP or Compaq or Dell doesn't like the terms that Microsoft requires for selling Microsoft's operating system, well, they can sell somebody else's operating system. There are plenty of other operating systems out there. If consumers don't like the bundle that is offered by Microsoft and they prefer an alternative, well, they're, you know, entrepreneurs are free to produce alternatives and offer them to consumers. So, you know, there's kind of a presumption sometimes that, you know, among government regulators and commentators that, you know, business should be done a certain way. Products should be produced a certain way and priced a certain way, and any deviation from that must be, quote unquote, anti-competitive. Well, that's a very mistaken notion of competition, right? Competition in the Austrian sense is simply, you know, the freedom for entrepreneurs to try to sell things to consumers and the freedom of consumers to buy or not to buy as they see fit. As long as we have private property and no government intervention in the pricing process, we have competition. Whether that results in just a few large firms or many small firms doesn't matter. As long as there's free entry, the market is still competitive. And that brings me to kind of the underlying major theme about these complaints about Microsoft that are related to our discussion this week. You know, a lot of the criticism against Microsoft rested on a view that, well, you know, Microsoft is very large and does have a very large share of the market, but that does not mean that Microsoft is better than other firms at satisfying consumer preferences. Rather, they said in markets like, you know, operating for products like operating systems or productivity applications or browsers or whatever, there are huge economies of scale, demand-side economies of scale, such as network effects. And therefore, these are markets that are extremely prone to tipping, right? They are winner-take-most markets. And remember, in that argument about tipping and winner-take-most, the claim is the winner may not be the best provider, right? A firm can end up with a dominant share of the market, not because it produces the best product, but simply because it was the first mover or because of some idiosyncratic kind of accidental fact of history that gave it a slight head start over its rivals, and then due to the network effect, there was this kind of, you know, convergence on that one product in which it became the dominant, you know, the dominant provider in the market, the dominant product in the market. We'll have a lot more to say about this next week when we talk about network effects, so-called network externalities, and, you know, how we might try to reconcile these notions of winner-take-most markets with, you know, consumer sovereignty and the freedom of market participants to do what they want and so on. So what you had going on in Microsoft, Michael, was an underlying belief that Microsoft was really no good, right? That consumers really didn't like Microsoft products, but had been kind of forced into buying them because, you know, by accident and due to clever marketing, they had become the dominant provider, and there was nothing consumers could do about it. With that background in mind, there were a number of specific complaints about Microsoft's licensing practices, its pricing strategies, and so on, claiming that it was unfairly taking advantage of its dominant position to harm consumers. I'm not terribly sympathetic, as you can probably tell, to those particular complaints about Microsoft. Hakan is pointing out, you know, it's more complicated in a world of intellectual property. And this is something we'll touch on more in week five. Right, so one could argue that firms like Microsoft that have a patent protection or copyright protection, as we'll see in week five, there are important differences between copyright and patent, and most software is actually copyrighted rather than patented. But the point is firms that can sort of keep out their rivals through virtue of their intellectual property holdings have kind of an unfair government-granted privilege that makes it difficult for rivals to compete in the marketplace. As you'll see in week five, I'm very sympathetic to that argument, that general property rights argument. In this case, the question is, you know, look, all firms in the tech business, hardware, software, telecom, services, whatever, you know, they all play the patent and copyright game. And partly that's because it's, you know, sort of forced on them by necessity. When you are doing business in, you know, a so-called mixed economy, an economy with some private property but a heavy dose of government intervention, you have to play by some of the government's rules. You know, does doing so necessarily give you an unfair advantage over competitors? That's a little bit more difficult to say. So clearly, Microsoft used and continues to use intellectual property laws to its advantage, but so does every other competitor in the software and hardware market. It isn't obvious to me that this has given sort of differential benefits to Microsoft relative to the benefits that have been given to other players in the industry. But again, we'll talk a lot more about this in subsequent weeks of the course. Okay, Maggie has a question. Examples of information goods with a low fixed cost of production as well as a low marginal cost of reproduction. That's a good question, Maggie. I imagine, do you have something specific in mind? I mean, as we discussed on Wednesday, we usually think of information goods having a higher initial cost or fixed cost, and then a lower cost of production. So, you know, it's a lot of work to write the book, but once you have written a book, the cost of producing an extra copy of the book is fairly low. The same thing would apply to you know, software and so on. Yeah, I mean, I think I see what Maggie's getting at is, you know, can you have technological innovation that lowers this initial fixed cost so that while it's, you know, it may still be high relative to the ongoing operations, it's not that high or it's not that much higher. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, think of publishing a book, you know, in the old days of movable type, not movable type, the blogging platform, but, you know, actual little pieces of those lead slugs that printers would move around, you know, from Gutenberg until 1970s or whatever. You know, to produce a page using one of those old-timey printing presses, you know, take the printer a whole day to arrange the little letters, you know, the little, I think, slugs they call them, you know, into the right positions. Once you have it like that, then you can just go, you know, bang, bang, bang with the handle, or you turn the crank or whatever, and you can produce page after page after page after page after page for, you know, the cost of the paper, basically, and the marginal cost of the ink. You might argue, well, today, you know, because of software and other innovations, it's a lot less expensive to set up the page, right? You know, cheap blogging software and Twitter and, you know, even just word processing software, the cost of kind of producing and setting up that initial page is a lot lower than it was in the old days, you know, before computer technology. I mean, I'm sure that's true, but I guess I would say even in that case, you know, writing the blog entry is more costly in terms of, you know, the opportunity cost of your time, for example, than, you know, the cost to your server of delivering one more page view. Okay, so if you're a blogger, it costs you the same in terms of, you know, out-of-pocket expense for your hosting fees, the cost of your time to write a blog entry, if you get 5 hits or if you get 5,000 hits. So if we think of each additional page view as sort of producing one more unit of output, it's still the case that, you know, the more hits you have, the lower the cost per hit. I think that's really kind of the only thing that we're getting at. And of course, Maggie is right that the upfront production cost has gone down in many, many cases. You know, again, it also depends on whether we think of, do we mean kind of the physical costs, the monetary costs, or do we mean just the, you know, the thinking cost, right? So, you know, if you write an article and Jeff Tucker runs it on Mises.org, it's hard to write a good article. If you're producing software, you know, it's hard to write software. It's easier to program a computer by writing a software program to do X, Y, Z than it might have been to get that task performed 100 years ago using sticks or rocks or, you know, human labor or whatever. But, you know, once you've done it, you still want to produce as many copies as you can, I guess. Okay. Glennis has a question about pirating. What do I think the impact of using pirated goods has on intellectual copyright laws and attempts to control speech and information? Yeah, that's a really good question. Linus, if I understand you correctly, in fact, I was talking to our good friend Stefan Kinsella about this just yesterday. I guess these days there's increasing scrutiny of intellectual property. The current intellectual property regime, you know, coming from all across the political spectrum, not primarily from libertarians, though thanks to Stefan and others, libertarians have a pretty strong voice here, but even liberals, left-wingers, the well-known liberal blogger Matt Iglesias had a piece at the beginning of this week attacking IP and claiming that it really sets up special monopoly privileges for, you know, big firms that are connected to the state and so on. And I think most libertarians would agree with that. You know, is it likely that IP laws will be radically reformed, or that IP would even be abolished anytime soon? No, I doubt it. And I should point out that, you know, this is a controversial issue, even among libertarian scholars and practitioners. So I don't want to assume that everybody is in the anti-IP camp. That's the one that has kind of generated the most buzz within libertarian circles, but it isn't a universally shared view among libertarians. But anyway, the point is, I don't know how likely it is that we'll have kind of formal legal reform or even repeal of different parts of, you know, IP law. However, it's possible that, you know, kind of de facto, the effectiveness of IP will kind of crumble, you know, bit by bit until, you know, in practice, it doesn't really mean much, right? And we've already seen that happen in a number of areas, a number of parts of the world, you know, in China and so on, where you can get, IP laws. U.S.-style IP laws are not enforced the same way, and you know, regardless of what the law says, in practice, major, you know, movie studios cannot keep pirated copies of their movies out of people's hands in many parts of the world, of course, including the U.S. or the EU or wherever you guys reside. You know, look, we all know, you know, what happened to poor old Napster. You know, the design of Napster was such that even though it, you know, it's a peer-to-peer kind of system, there was a central There's sort of central nodes that lawsuits could target and that the government could shut down and so on. But, other, the newest kind of, today's kind of peer-to-peer sharing systems, BitTorrent clients and so on, it doesn't look like there's any way that the record studios, music industry, Hollywood, and its government allies can shut down BitTorrent. Maybe they want to, but they just haven't figured out how, and it's not clear really that they can. These guys, the Swedish founders of the Pirate Bay, a notorious BitTorrent hosting site, are, they're under attack. They're being sued by, sued in Sweden. But look, their system is still up, right? I mean, the maybe Julian Assange, whether you think he's a hero or a villain, maybe he will be in, arrested in Sweden. Maybe he'll be extradited to the U.S. Maybe he'll end up in Guantanamo Bay. Who knows? But it doesn't seem likely that, the content of these WikiLeaks documents are going to go away because they're now distributed. Assange's former colleagues who are, there's sort of a split and they've founded their own WikiLeaks type of thing. I mean, once you let that genie out of the bottle, there simply is no way that the legal system or government officials can't put the genie back in, right? So it may be that in practice, IP enforcement simply will become a lot weaker or will have to take a radically different form because it just isn't technically feasible to kind of enforce the laws the way they're written now. Bit by bit, I wasn't clever enough to come up with that on purpose. That was that was inadvertent. So could it be byte by byte or 8-bit by 8-bit? That would make a nice Think Geek kind of a t-shirt maybe. I don't know, Linus, if I'm getting at the kind of thing that you're talking about. If you've been watching the news this week, all the stuff going on in Egypt, last week in Tunisia, it used to be a common saying that the major driver of the fall of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the failure of communism, the ending of communism in Eastern Europe, Glasnost and Perestroika and so on, it wasn't the Reagan administration's military buildup. It wasn't the Pope, although the Pope may have played a role. People say, the major thing was the fax machine, that for the first time inside Russia and other Soviet bloc countries, courtesy of the fax machine, people were getting access to information that they never had before. They were getting access to news from, Western media sources and sources outside the U.S., and it was simply impossible for the Russian state to control the flow of information, even if it wanted to. So you could argue whether Gorbachev had a change of heart or not. Even the hardest line member of the Soviet Politburo realized that they just couldn't hold it together even if they wanted to. I'm guessing, I don't know all the details about the sort of revolt in Tunisia last week. I don't know the details about the prime minister or the president who had to flee. I'm sure he wasn't a good guy, long-serving authoritarian ruler and so on. I doubt that he suddenly decided, it's a bad thing that I've been ruling this way for so long, and I really need to flee the country and allow a little bit more freedom, among the population. No, I think he just realized he was dead because, these riot, these protests were being organized through Twitter and through social networking sites and, text messaging. There simply was no way the government could control the flow of information to prevent that from happening. And from what I understand, is the same thing going on in Egypt now. Will Mubarak and his party leave? And they've been in power. He's been in power for 30 years. He's a pretty tough, brutal authoritarian leader. I doubt he's softening up, but he may be forced out. That government may collapse simply because the state cannot control the flow of information the way they want to. Now, does the state? Do state officials want to control information? Well, duh, of course they do. You remember the, what do they call it in is during the last presidential administration, this Department of Defense CIA project, they bungled it politically by naming it TIA, Total Information Awareness, a really scary Orwellian name for, a set of algorithms that are designed to suck up data from networks that the government can get access to and to analyze the data and look for patterns and, look at people's credit card records and text messages and emails and try to sniff out, who's a terrorist and so on. I mean, you can imagine, there's a heck of a lot of, server power and computer processing power all around the world being devoted to exactly this: government spying on everybody and everyone, everywhere and every person, including their own citizens, to try to, get it, they say to fight terrorism and so on, but who knows what the real objectives are. It's sort of an interesting battle. Can the government keep ahead? I just don't know how effectively they really can do that. Cheap encryption software is so easy. Any one of us can encrypt our emails and encrypt our computers if we really want to, with keys or ciphers that probably even the NSA couldn't break. Most of us don't bother to do that because we don't feel like things have gotten to that point. But if the state, were to overstep its bounds in the minds of the average citizen, even more than it already has, if people were really committed to protecting their privacy through technology, if the average person was, the tools are out there. A lot of you probably know a lot more about this than I do, but I just don't know how, to what extent governments can do the things that they want to do. Will this ultimately result in more free and liberal, in the classical sense of the word, liberal societies? I don't know, but it's certainly, it's certainly a possibility. Linus, let me know if that's not sort of what you're asking about. Let's see. Michael, I'm looking at your question. Does this genie reflect Benkler's view on the wealth-enhancing view of networks? That's a good question. I mean, I guess so. Benkler is thinking, not just of wealth, material wealth, and he's not thinking of liberty or freedom kind of in the libertarian sense, but rather in the kind of left liberal empowerment sense. But yeah, I guess he would claim that once you've kind of unleashed the power of what he calls commons-based peer production, peer-to-peer networking and Wikipedia and so on, you can't ever get rid of it. You can't ever go back. So that maybe he does have a kind of genie out of the bottle idea in mind as too, in mind as well, though with a slightly different application. Okay, Matthew has some good questions. Do you believe that some of the misconceptions and problems with government regulation of the new economy are due to mainstream economists' emphasis on perfect competition, which may not be the optimal form or even possible for the distribution of information goods, let alone any type of good? Matthew, that's a terrific question. I mean, you answered the question brilliantly. The answer is yes. I can't say it any better than you did. Now, those of you in the course who have not taken a mainstream neoclassical microeconomic theory course, it's okay. You may not have been exposed as much to so-called perfect competition theory as those of you who have taken those courses, but in a nutshell, right, mainstream microeconomics is dominated by one particular model of so-called competition, which has been criticized by Austrians since the 1940s, when it became a dominant, sort of dominant view in the economics profession, as a completely unrealistic notion of competition. It's very static, it's sort of equilibrium bound, it's highly artificial. It's a model of competition in which you have, lots and lots and lots, technically speaking, an infinite number of teeny, 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 tiny firms, none of which is able to sort of influence the market in any way. It's like the idea of mass democracy, right? That no individual voter's vote matters on the margin because the number of voters is so large, yet collectively the voters determine the winner of the election. The so-called model of perfect competition is like that. We have these little teeny tiny firms, little teeny tiny consumers, and each one is so small relative to the market that they can't influence the market in any way on the margin. Yet collectively, their actions somehow determine, equilibrium prices and quantities. The relevance for antitrust is that for and regulation is that for a long time, economists, government officials said, well, this highly abstract, artificial, and unrealistic model of perfect competition represents some kind of an ideal. We realize real-world markets aren't quite that good, but that's the benchmark. That's what we should be aiming for. And what, government policy should do is look at real markets, see how far away they are from this blackboard textbook ideal, and then try to push them in that direction. So if you see a market with a small number of large firms, they must have done something bad. It must be harmful to consumers, so we need to use the antitrust laws to break them up and split them into, smaller firms. In perfect competition, in the model of perfect competition, every consumer pays the same price for each unit of the good. So if you see a real-world market in which sellers are charging different prices to different consumers or different groups of consumers, ah, that must be evil, bad, horrible. The government has to ban this. These firms are doing predatory pricing or illegal price fixing or price discrimination, and the government has to stamp it out. So, Michael's exactly right. Real-world markets, in any industry, do not look very much like the so-called perfectly competitive model. And that's especially true in technology markets, markets with network effects, markets for information goods, and so on. They don't at all look like so-called perfectly competitive, textbook markets. And therefore, if regulators are applying their usual rule of thumb, well, if it doesn't look like perfect competition, it's bad and we should intervene, well, then they're going to be intervening all over the place in technology markets. And, from an Austrian perspective, making things worse rather than making things better. Let's see. Ta-ta-ta-ta. Oh, yeah, differences between information and knowledge. Yeah, Jeff, this is a good question. In retrospect, I think I probably wasn't as clear on Wednesday as I could have been. Again, some of it is semantic. How we define information or knowledge, well, you can define them in different ways. Really, the point that I'm trying to get at is that there's kind of a heterogeneity of knowledge, okay? That some kinds of knowledge can be encapsulated or captured in data, where data means numbers, or data could be words, right? And therefore communicated or transferred to another person, from one person to another. Other kinds of knowledge or other kinds of information are not like that, right? Because either they're tacit, they're impossible to articulate, they're too idiosyncratic, it's specialized knowledge of a scientific type, and it cannot be communicated from one person to another. So if we want to define these different, say there's two types of knowledge, easy to transfer, difficult to transfer, right? So you think, well, who won the Lakers game last night? Well, I mean, I don't know, but it's pretty easy to find out. I can just go look that up, with just a few mouse clicks, right? What are Danny Sanchez's long-term career plans? Well, I don't know. I mean, I could ask him. Well, first of all, maybe I don't know him. I don't know where to find him, so I can't get that information. Maybe I do know him. I can email him or call him. Maybe he doesn't really answer. He doesn't want to answer. Or he says, gosh, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I've been thinking about it for a while, and, I have a vague idea in my mind of what I'd like to do, but I just can't really describe it. Okay, well, that knowledge is in Danny's head, but I can't get it. Maybe Danny can't even express it to himself in a particular way, right? So those are different kinds of knowledge or information. So again, it's semantics. If we want, we could use the term information to refer to those things that are transferable, and use the term knowledge to refer to those things that are not transferable or are costly to transfer. Or we could use another terminological distinction, the one that I mentioned on Wednesday, the one that comes out of Hayek and other writers inspired by Hayek, is to say that what can be transferred we'll call general knowledge. What cannot be transferred we'll call specific knowledge. So maybe information and general knowledge are substitutes, synonyms, and specific knowledge, or just knowledge if you prefer, you know, is the stuff that is tacit, scientific, idiosyncratic, hard to articulate. Okay? Does that make sense, Jeff? I mean, right, the implication, obviously, is that you know, we're interested in markets, and Hayek was interested in planning, and so on. Right? If all of the information or knowledge that we cared about was general knowledge, easy to transfer, or information that's easy to transfer from one person to another, well, then we could have, you know, total world central planning with Danny as our libertarian dictator in charge, right? Because the dictator would be able to do everything that individuals can do and more just by getting their information. There's a little problem. You have to motivate individuals, you know, to be sort of willing to provide that information. But Mises and Hayek, you know, thought that even if people were willing to serve the libertarian dictator, the libertarian dictator still would not be able to allocate resources effectively. The dictator wouldn't know what to do. And the way Hayek formulated the problem was because a lot of the necessary knowledge is hard to articulate, hard to express, because it's tacit or scientific or idiosyncratic. Therefore, central planning doesn't work. That was Hayek's way of conceiving the problem. Oh, yeah, thanks, Linus, for the some links on the Soviet Union. Yeah, those of you who have, if you can add to or elaborate on any of this with your own experience, your industry experience, or country experience, certainly be very glad to have it. And maybe, you know, the Lithuanian example with, you know, with broadcast TV and fax machines and so on, provide some important lessons that might allow us to anticipate how things are going to go in other parts of the world now that are more repressive. And it's worth mentioning, just by the way, a word about China. You know, there are some, I'm no China expert, but some people I know who are China experts say that, look, de jure, right, legally, formally, China is governed, you know, it's a one-party communist state. It's a very authoritarian society and so on. But they say de facto, particularly the farther away you get from Beijing, out of the countryside, the enforcement of the government's strict rules is pretty lax. And so in practice, in some ways, China is more of a capitalist free market economy than the U.S., even though nominally, officially, it's still communist. In practice, it's capitalist, because there simply is no way the communist authorities can do everything they claim that they can do or have the right to do, okay? Yeah, Michael is pointing out, in fact, several of you in the comments are pointing out other, you know, readings on perfect competition. I'll try to think of some other citations that would be useful. Kirzner has been a great, criticized the perfectly competitive model, criticizes that model as leaving out the entrepreneur. A really good essay by Hayek, was originally in 19... The essay was written in 1946, I believe, and it's published in Hayek's 1948 book, Individualism and Economic Order. The essay is called The Meaning of Competition, which is quite excellent. And there's a fairly recent book, about a decade or so old, by a guy named Frank Machovec, M-A-C-H-O-V-E-C, that is called something like Perfect Competition and the Transformation of Economics, that gives a really good history of how economists, you know, began, where this model of perfect competition came from, how it came to dominate the profession, and everything that's wrong with it. If you just go to Mises.org and Google perfect competition, you'll find lots and lots of good articles kind of giving more detail on what's wrong with it, and the application to technology markets and markets for information goods is pretty interesting. I think it should be pretty straightforward. Um, Yeah, Hakan, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by the term indirect competition. Maybe you can just tell me how you define that term. There's what they call implicit competition or potential competition. From firms that are not currently in the market but could potentially get in at low cost, and their presence might serve to discipline the incumbent, keep prices lower than they otherwise would be. Strictly speaking, perfect competition has identical firms producing identical products, but there are sort of versions of the model that are more relaxed, that have products that are imperfect substitutes for each other, and some of those models have similarities to the so-called perfect competition model. Okay, let's see. Okay, let's see. Yeah, it's funny. I'm looking at the discussion of Sweden here. It's a very good point. My PhD student Per Bieland, who some of you may know because he writes on Mises.org occasionally, particularly on Sweden, has some good articles on this. I mean, Hakan's point about regulation in the Nordic countries is exactly right. You often hear kind of left liberal socialist types saying, well, look at the Nordic countries. Look at Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Finland. They rank very high in terms of economic prosperity. These are extremely wealthy countries. They have well-educated populations. They score very high on these so-called happiness indexes. Yet, they have they're socialist countries with cradle-to-grave welfare state. Therefore, socialism can be economically efficient if it's done the right way. Therefore, the welfare state is good for the economy if it's done the right way, according, to the so-called Swedish model. Hakan is pointing out exactly what's wrong with those claims. Namely, it is true that compared to the U.S. and some other countries around the world, the welfare system, is bigger in Sweden and Denmark and Norway and so on. Personal income tax rates are very, very high. Hakan, you tell us what the income tax rate is, 50%, 60%, 70%. However, the Nordic countries have fairly unregulated capital markets. They have very little business regulation, very low and sometimes zero, business tax rates, corporate income tax rates. In many ways, on the production side, the Nordic countries are a lot more free market than the U.S. or other parts of Europe or whatever. So what does it mean to say Sweden is a socialist country? Well, it does have the sort of socialist welfare system and medical system and so on, but on the industrial side, it's very capitalist. In fact, if you look at these economic freedom rankings, especially if you break them down into individual categories, the Nordic countries often score extremely high on economic freedom indexes, much higher than the U.S. or U.K. or whatever, countries that are supposed to be more free. So on some dimensions, the Nordic countries are pretty socialistic. On other dimensions, they're pretty capitalistic. On balance, they may be more capitalistic than the U.S. Michael is asking a question about the Shapiro book. Do I like that book? Yes, I do like it. I think that book by Shapiro called Foundations of the Market Price System is very, very good. It's written as an introductory textbook for beginning students of economics, but I think it's also useful as providing a slightly different, more Austrian perspective on value theory, production theory, price theory, exchange theory, even for those of you who have taken some economics courses before. Now, the manuscript was written back in the 70s, and it doesn't look like a textbook. It's the typesetting is very primitive, and it's a very sort of old-fashioned, looks like it was typed on an old-fashioned typewriter, but I think the contents are really, really excellent. Joe Salerno and I used a lot of that material in doing our fundamentals of what do we call it? Fundamentals of I can't even remember. our price theory lecture series, Fundamentals of Economic Analysis, that's it. A lot of it, our exposition was based on the way Shapiro does it. So yes, I certainly do recommend it. Danny's reminding us that there's a Mises Academy course taught by Tom DiLorenzo coming up just a few weeks, dealing specifically with antitrust regulation, monopoly theory, and those kinds of things. And he will emphasize this kind of Austrian critique of perfect competition models, and that I think is very good. The chapter about perfect competition. Yeah, I think so. I'll have to go back and look. I don't have the book in front of me to remember specifically what he does in that chapter, but I would imagine that it's quite good. I can look for some other resources as well. General critiques of perfect competition theory. But yeah, I would imagine Shapiro is probably pretty good at that. Let's see. Okay, Matthew's asking, does the university where I teach stress Austrian economics? No, it doesn't, but I am located in a department that is very, very tolerant of, shall we say, unusual kind of deviant views. So, we don't have any kind of a formal Austrian program, but in the applied economics PhD program, for example, where I teach, every semester I teach some courses in organization and institution theory, organizational institutional theory that includes some Austrian content. I taught a PhD course in entrepreneurship a couple years ago that included a lot of Austrian material. And this past semester, partly in response to demands by the students, I offered a PhD course in Austrian economics and had quite a few students sign up. We had about 10 students in there, which doesn't seem like a lot for an undergraduate class, but that's a pretty big number for a PhD seminar. And actually, 5 of these students will be presenting papers at the Austrian Student Scholars Conference in Grove City, which is coming up next month. So we kind of have an Austrian movement here at the University of Missouri, but it's not because of any official recognition or official sponsorship from the university. We just happen to have quite a few students and, myself and a couple of other faculty who are kind of at least mildly curious about it, and we have a lack of hostility towards Austrian economics, as you might find in some other universities. So, I mean, one of the good things about the kind of Austrian revival is, any kind of intellectual movement needs institutional support. And in the early days of the Austrian movement, late in the, mid to late 1970s, early 1980s, there were just sort of a small number of schools, a few institutions, think tanks, whatever, foundations that were supporting Austrian economics. Now it's become much more diverse. So you have a number of different schools that offer, beginning, intermediate, and even advanced doctoral level training in Austrian economics in the U.S., in Europe, and elsewhere. There are a number of different undergraduate courses. There are lots of programs, the Summer Mises University being a good example of something that attracts, up to 200 or more than 200 students every year taking a wide variety of courses on Austrian subjects. So my point is, if you are a student interested in taking an Austrian course or learning more about Austrian economics, don't worry if you don't happen to live in a town that has an Austrian university located in it. Chances are you don't have that. Chances are your local college or university is not an Austrian hotbed. But there are lots of places around the world where you can go and get Austrian content, face-to-face in class. And obviously there's a whole, all the online resources, Mises Academy, lots of other short courses and programs offered by the Mises Institute and many, many other organizations and institutions where one can get good Austrian training. People are naming some particular schools. There are a lot of colleges. Bob Murphy used to teach at Hillsdale, where he taught an Austrian course, as did Richard Ebeling. Grove City College in Pennsylvania has, its undergraduate economics program is all almost entirely Austrian. You could go to a website like If you look at the list of adjunct professors at Mises.org, there's a long list of professors at different schools all over the world who teach Austrian economics in their courses, and you know, you can look at their universities and find them scattered all over the place. Let's see. We're sort of switching gears here. Danny's got a question about Mises' views on production theory. There is some production theory in human action, but not a lot compared to the amount of time Mises spends on other things. So if you just look at the table of contents, if you compare Man Economy and State to Human Action, I mean, Man Economy and State has, I don't know, at least five chapters that are almost exclusively devoted to production theory. Human Action has basically one. So Rothbard actually says, you know, when he, in his memoirs, when he talks about the writing of Man, Economy, and State, you know, he originally received a commission from a foundation to write sort of a short textbook on Austrian economics that would be kind of, you know, Mises for Dummies. And he started working on it, and it started to grow, and the project became longer. And Rothbard reports that, you know, as he studied Mises' works, he realized that Mises had left a lot of holes and gaps in his exposition. There were whole areas of economic theory that Mises just barely touched on before moving on to something else. You know, partly because, remember, Mises considered Human Action not to be a textbook or kind of an intro book, but as really an advanced treatise, the main audience of which would be people who were already professional economists. So Mises just kind of mentions little things in passing, expecting that his reader knows exactly what kind of, you know, technical subject he's referring to, when most of us don't. That's why it's helpful to have, you know, some annotation. There's a little companion that was written by Percy Greaves called Mises Made Easier, which has definitions of some of Mises' more obscure terms and so on. And that's very useful. But Rothbard says, as he was, you know, writing Man, Economy, and State, he realized that in particular, Mises had not done much with production theory, and that Rothbard had to fill in a lot of gaps, and that Rothbard actually combined Mises and Mises' Austrian predecessors with other scholars who were not part of the Austrian school per se, but are kind of fellow travelers, like J.B. Clark, Frank Fetter, Herbert Davenport, Philip Wicksteed, and others who had develop aspects of production theory in ways that Mises really hadn't. That's a roundabout way of saying no. To my knowledge, Mises did not write up, did not do anything beyond what's in Human Action, sort of on the production side, with a few exceptions. There's a Mises article on monopoly that includes information that's not in Human Action, but has been published separately in the QJAE in the last few years. You guys are asking good questions about you know, being a university student debt. I mean, maybe someday I'd like to offer a Mises Academy course on the economics of higher education. I think there's a lot of good work that Austrians can do, because higher education is such a mess. And, you know, there are a lot of studies indicating that going to a regular college or university does not provide good value per dollar. You know, not only the huge debt load, but, you know, the content of what you get is not so, you know, it's just really not all that good. You might go, some of you may know Richard Vedder, V-E-D-D-E-R, who's a very good free market economist. He has been working in this area a lot lately, and has a blog that's called something like the Center for College Affordability. If you just Google that, you can find his blog. He has a lot of good stuff about the problems with the value of higher degrees. There's a lot of literature on this by education scholars in the mainstream complaining about problems with the higher education system. And so anyway, you know, if what you really want is education, then independent study, the Mises Academy, attending events, special programs like Mises University is probably a better way to get it than you know, enrolling at Harvard or your local two-year or four-year school. But, of course, I'm a little bit biased on that. Oh, Ian has asked a question about, Ian says, do you know of anyone applying Austrian theory to agent-based computational economics? And the answer is yes, actually I do. There's a whole sort of small subfield genre of people doing this. Let me think, what's the best way to get that information to you? How about, I tell you what, Ian, if you wouldn't mind starting a thread in one of the forums, just asking about this, and I'll reply to that in the forum so everybody can see with the names and URLs of some folks who are working on that. There's one economist in Washington, D.C. who's done quite a bit on this. I know one guy at Texas A&M who's working on it. Actually, one of my colleagues here at Missouri is doing some agent-based simulations that are not explicitly Austrian. But he's trying to model different aspects of entrepreneurship using agent-based models. And I can give you some the names of some people to contact and some URLs that you might want to pursue. So, okay, well, hey guys, I think it's our hour is about up. Anybody have a last-minute question that you're desperate to get an answer to right away? Otherwise, your dear professor has some boring faculty meetings to attend and other things to busy work to do. Oh, Packers or Steelers? You know, I've always, when I was a kid, I was a big Steelers fan, partly because in those days the Steelers and the Cowboys were in the Super Bowl pretty much every year, and my older brother was a Cowboys fan, so just to be difficult, I became a Steelers fan, even though I didn't live in Pittsburgh. Didn't really have much of a connection to Pittsburgh. I think I did it mainly to annoy my older brother. Now, I was quite effective in that. But I've always kind of liked the Steelers ever since. And you know, the Packers are okay, but you know, it's hard for me to really like the Packers without Brett Favre, even though Brett Favre has gotten really weird in the last few years, as you know. But anyway, well, hope you guys have a great rest of the week. Let's keep our discussion going on the discussion board, the discussion forums. Danny and I will have a short quiz ready for you later this afternoon, and I look forward to seeing all of you next week. Bye-bye.